funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The last time you planned a big domestic trip, did you consider taking a train? The construction of transcontinental rail lines was a revolutionary development in American history, and for a long time, railroads provided the most efficient, comfortable, and even elegant way for people to travel long distances. Today, the story is quite different. Most of us cross the country in private vehicles or cheap airline seats. President Obama's campaign pledge to invest in high-speed rail development seems to have hit a dead end, and the vast majority of train cars in this country carry freight rather than people. So have we squandered an opportunity for a better alternative? Kevin Baker is a contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. His cover story for the July issue is called 21st Century Limited, The Lost Glory of America's Railroads. Kevin, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of train travel did you do yourself as you researched the story?
I went across country and back on Amtrak's passenger trains, traveling in a compartment each time, and it was terrific. I really, for the most part, it was very comfortable, and I had a great time on it. You know, there are several drawbacks to it. It can often be a difficult experience to try to get a full night's sleep in the Amtrak compartment, but it was overall just really an amazing experience.
And it's hard to sleep because the train does stop and start and make noises, is that it?
It stops and starts a lot, and it rattles and shakes. You know, on my honeymoon, my wife and I took a trip up to Montreal, and she was joking that the sleeper should be called the restless dozer, you know. It's like that kind of mechanical banging around that can make it kind of inconvenient. But, of course, that has to be the case because these trains now share lines with all sorts of freight trains and other trains, local commuter trains.
Mm-hmm. So who rides trains these days on a regular basis for long-distance travel? For whom is this not a once-in-a-lifetime occasion?
Well, I was finding that it was a lot of sort of older people enjoying themselves and taking retirement trips, a lot of tourists from Britain and the British Commonwealth countries, but really, and also a great many people who hate flying, which has become a worse and worse experience. But really, it's amazing the variety of Americans on the train. You know, I met in the same afternoon, I met the first Amish person I'd ever talked to and the first Mennonite. There's really an incredible variety of people of all races, creeds, colors. You know, it's quite moving in that way.
And there are people that only go on trains not because they see the travel not as a means to an end, but as the train trip as sort of the end in itself. And they're called foamers, right, by Amtrak crew members. What does that term refer to?
Yeah, that's an unfortunately rather scornful term that Amtrak employees have for train enthusiasts, of whom there are quite a few. And while I'm not the worst example of a foamer, I count myself among them. People just love trains. There's just something about it. You know, I kept asking people what they liked about trains, and they kept saying the romance of it. And they could never really define that, and yet I sort of know what they mean. There's something about traveling at that, you know, there's something about a train, first of all, that's astounding. And there's something about traveling at that pace that is terrific. It's really a very comfortable way to travel for the most part, particularly in the day when you sit out in these observation cars on Amtrak trains west of the Mississippi. These are up at, like, you know, these are double-decker trains. You're sitting up there in a seat that faces the side. There are these, you know, amazing windows that are go all the way up to the ceiling there. And you can just look out and see all of America passing by, and you can, you know, have your drink at the side or a snack and, you know, listen to music or read or something. It's really a terrific way to travel from a very practical point of view that way. But also there's just something about trains that that just kind of overawe us and that we, some of us at least, tend to love.
We're so accustomed to getting everywhere in cars, and we know what the views look like. And even if you're on a pretty desolate stretch of road, you know that lots of other people go that way. It's occurred to me on trains and also, strangely, on rafting trips that when you are far away from a road, you're seeing something that you wouldn't accidentally come upon if you were in any other vehicle.
Sure. I think that's a very good point. And I found out, you know, there was a washout in the Rockies on this trip coming back, which is rare. But it meant I got to unfortunately miss a scenic part of the Rockies, which was too bad. But we did get rerouted through Wyoming and along the route used by the original Transcontinental Rail. It's now a freight route, but we were rerouted along this. And it was quite amazing to be in a part of America where for miles and miles and miles there was nothing man-made except for a few, you know, snow fences along the way. Just the prairie out there. No highways, no houses, no nothing for most of the time. And that was quite remarkable to see.
How's the food?
The food, you know, it's okay. It's sort of airline style. It's you know, kind of prepackaged and reheated. It's definitely edible. And it's free if you're in a compartment, you know. Or a roomette. It's decent, you know. I won't go beyond that. It used to be some of the best food in the country. You know, that's why we have diners all over the place, because rail diners churned out an incredible variety of food and really terrific food in the country, you know, as per the different regions it went through. Hmm. And this was really, you know, and they would do it at all hours of the day or night in these tiny, tiny kitchens. It was really a miraculous feat. And now you don't have that, unfortunately. But the real attraction of that Amtrak dining room is really more the company than the food. You know, it's a way they seat you, of course, with your family and friends, but they also seat you otherwise with strangers. And it really works terrifically well. It's kind of a traveling bed and breakfast in that sense. And I just met some, you know, wonderful people along the way.
Hmm. So talk about how traveling when you did, it compares with what you understand about traveling on the luxury lines like the 20th Century Limited decades ago.
Oh yeah, I mean this is nothing like the old kind of, you know, the old kind of limited and express trains, which were luxury trains, but they were also something that a middle class person could be on, and they were kind of incredible. You know, I mean, for instance, the 20th Century Limited, the legendary train from New York to Chicago and back, had all kinds of things on it. It was, they literally rolled out the red carpet in Grand Central Terminal when you were going to get on it in the, you know, in the late afternoon. And women passengers were given flowers and given bottles of perfume. They gave the men carnations for their buttonholes. You know, and the train had a barbershop on board and a post office. It had manicurists and masseuses and secretaries and, you know, everybody take care of all your business needs as you sped along. And it would go from New York to Chicago in 16 hours, you know, which was nothing travels that fast by land today. You know, and this was quite extraordinary. You know, this is why people wrote an amazing number of variety of songs about trains. They wrote plays and comedies about, you know, the 20th century was, you know, a big Broadway hit and a movie. You know, this was an extremely attractive, glamorous way of traveling. And at the end of it, these train stations became places where the elite would gather. You know, it's the Oyster Bar in Grand Central became this sort of legendary meeting place for movie stars and politicians and others just getting off the train from Chicago or just about to board it to Chicago. You know, you'd meet and have a drink at the Oyster Bar, and it was, it was a very glamorous lifestyle in that way.
You know, Kevin, with all the talk about high-speed rail these days, I was really surprised to read that it took less time to get from New York to Chicago in 1938 than it does today.
Yes, because you had the 20th Century Limited, which you know, again, only made like five stops, you know, and the train today does not, you know, make something like 18, so that's not possible in that sense. But, yeah, it's really sort of a technological regression that we've gone through. I mean, really, even on the Northeast Corridor, which is where they've made both attempts to kind of build up a high-speed Amtrak line, trains average something like 69 miles an hour, which is pretty much what they were doing back in 1970. You know, you had the attempts at a Metroliner train back then that were even that sometimes went faster than the Amtrak Acela today. And it's, you know, this is really a shame. I mean, I don't think we would ever have high-speed trains the way places like Europe or Asia have. It would be very hard to do it. I'm not sure they would serve a lot of America that well. I mean, these tend to be in relatively small countries with kind of central capitals and provincial capitals out of which you can build these spokes of trains, and it makes a lot of sense to run something from, you know, Madrid to Barcelona. If you built a high-speed rail across, say, the prairie from Chicago to Portland, Oregon, which is one of the trips I took, this is like a 48-hour trip. You know, even if you cut the time in half, it's still 24 hours. And if you have urgent business, you're still going to want to do it by plane. However, it would be a great idea to build kind of shorter high-speed rail corridors all over this country between various cities. And that's something that would take a lot of doing, but is possible and would really be beneficial.
It turns out, of course, that it is exceptionally expensive to add capacity to high-speed rail or rail in general. Can you talk a little bit about the promises that then-candidate Obama made about high-speed rail and what's happened to them?
Yeah, well, again, like, you know, the Obama administration, as I think so often the case, had an excellent plan that was slow and sloppy in execution. It was the idea was to increase spending for rails in general and also to concentrate on building maybe 10 to 13 of these high-speed corridors, about 100 to 600 miles, where you'd run trains at much higher speeds than they are now. And again, not up to like these record-setting trains in Europe or Asia, which are running at 200 miles an hour and make it up to 300, but, you know, you can maybe run them at 150 miles an hour, which would be an incredible improvement. However, he put forward a really small amount of money for this, $8 billion for the rail corridors, which really undermined the whole seriousness of the effort in the first place. And then on top of this, the time spent, deciding which corridors to go for first, took so long that Republican governors had taken over in three of the four states they finally decided on, in Ohio, Wisconsin, and in Florida. And the governors in these states dismissively turned down federal money for building any such thing as a rail corridor, which left just California. And California had already voted in a referendum, a little under $10 billion, to build a high-speed line with very limited stops from Los Angeles to San Francisco and Sacramento, the state capital. Sounded good in theory, but this has now gotten completely out of hand. And while the feds have put forward, I think it's $3.9 billion so far toward it, and they may end up putting all the appropriated high-speed money toward it. But it's the cost now is estimated anywhere from $68 to $91.5 billion and rising. And this has just turned into a boondoggle that I think will undermine the whole prospect of high-speed rail everywhere, unfortunately.
Author Kevin Baker is my guest. He's a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine and wrote the July cover story called 21st Century Limited, The Lost Glory of America's Railroads. If you'd like to ask a question, maybe tell a story about your own adventures with the railroad, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Kevin Baker, a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and author of its cover story this July called 21st Century Limited, The Lost Glory of America's Railroads. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Kevin, is there any question that railroads absolutely must have government subsidies in order to be commercially viable?
No, I don't think there's any question of that. And they always have had government subsidies. You know, in our recent debates in this country over who built what and, was it private enterprise or whatever, some people have put out the example of the Transcontinental Railroad as a place that private industry did. And, of course, that's nonsense. The Transcontinental Railroad was funded, up to its eyeballs by the government. And, in fact, the people who built it refused to do much of anything until the government provided huge subsidies. Almost every inch of intercity rail in this country, and intracity rail, too, has been funded heavily by the government. In fact, rail scandals, the funding of railroads in the 19th century became huge government scandals. The Credit Mobilier scandal and all about the Transcontinental. People were just not going to take these risks and cut through all the red tape necessary without the government, and particularly the federal government, coming in and providing land, providing money, providing guarantees. And I think that's still the case today. I think if you had, a lot of people would like to privatize Amtrak, theoretically, but I think that would lead to just chaos as these different states disputed who was going to put in what.
How does the energy efficiency of long-distance travel on a train compare with an automobile or an airplane?
Oh, it's much better, and it's particularly for an airplane, of course. It depends what you're talking about. Of course, if you theoretically you could have electric cars, running on energy generated by renewable sources, and you could have a diesel train, and of course the electric cars would be preferable. But as it now stands, trains are much preferable in environmental terms to cars. Having those all these people in one, one electrically generated train is a great advantage.
Is it cheaper to take a train?
Depends. In Amtrak on the Northeast Corridor, for instance, there are a lot of people who complain about the expense of it, and it can be expensive going from, say, New York to Boston. But a lot depends on what time you're doing it. If you're doing it off peak, it can be pretty cheap, pretty comparably cheap, particularly to airlines. And with all the problems with airline travel now, it's really reversed the equation. It used to be airlines got the vast majority, like two-thirds of the travel between rail and air, between Washington and Boston. And now it's about 75% of that ridership goes by train. I mean, airlines have canceled entire flights, scheduled flights between Washington and Boston because there's just no demand for it.
Is it theoretically feasible to add enough capacity to railroad lines to see an appreciable difference in freeway congestion?
Oh yeah, I mean that would be a huge part of the advantage of it. That you could get, the bigger problem is getting people out of their cars. People just prefer cars, a lot of times. But again, it's one of these things that sort of if you build it, they will come. If you have frequent, comfortable and affordable rail travel, I think you'll tempt a lot of people out of their cars. I mean, I've written an article about this George Will column in which he denounces the progressives for trying to, push rail travel on people as opposed to the great freedom of a car, Well, when you're, you know, you're stuck for 2 hours trying to get into a city in your car, you know, staring at the same billboards and listening to the same shock jock, you know, DJs. It's I don't think there's that much freedom compared to a train, you know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Gregory in Dallas. Hi, Gregory.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Great.
Yes, a good buddy of mine, Joe, is a supervisor for Amtrak and has taken me on several cross-country trips. And I beg to differ with the gentleman about the food. Duck, as we know, is always greasy. The duck was so delicious, I ate it for every meal. Delicious.
Right.
The salmon in the Northwest was superb. The buffalo steak or burger that you got going along the Lewis and Clark Trail was excellent. Granted, there's five-star restaurants out there in the world, but for a train, it's better than anything you'd get on an airline, as well as the people that work on the train are so courteous, much more courteous, I might add, than they are in the air travel industry, and it's just as clean, if not cleaner, than any filthy airplane that you sit on. So I think it was really enjoyable. If I had the time to travel like that, I would. I prefer it much more to flying. And remember, Jackie Gleason wasn't a flyer. He traveled everywhere on a train as well.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Gregory. I'm glad that you had such a good experience. And you also, Kevin, found staff to be very, very friendly.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that part of it, that the staff was really terrific. They were just sort of indefatigably efficient and courteous and just, you know, not, and, you know, because these Amtrak is really underfunded, you have these things go wrong. Like there was an electrical board that went out on this train, you know, on the train we were going back across country there on the California Zephyr to Chicago. So it made it impossible to really cook full meals in the kitchen. And, you know, it was just for the condition these workers are working in were just incredibly hot and sweaty and awful, but they were just immensely courteous nonetheless, and they dealt with all the problems. And they were just terrific throughout, the porters and the staff in the restaurants, in the dining cars, and you know, everybody. I just felt was for the, you know, you have the occasional exception here and there, but for the most part, they were really terrific.
Can you describe a sleeping car for us?
Oh yeah, it's a small compartment. It's got a couch that turns down into a bed that's, you know, comfortable and spacious. The bed, when it's out, takes up most of the compartment, but there's also room for another chair there. There is a nice little sink and all, and cabinets. There's the bath. The toilet chamber turns into the shower, which is not as hideous as it may sound, but it's but which does kind of, you know, once you shower in there, it kind of turns it into a swamp for about an hour. Mm-hmm. But it's generally very tenable. I mean, you can spend hours in there working, as I did, and just, you know, or just, you know, drinking a soda and looking out at the landscape and all sorts of things. It's really a very tenable space for one or two people to travel in. The roomettes are a little more, that's kind of like sitting, you know, almost knee to knee with somebody, maybe a stranger. I think those, they're a little crowded, but they're cheap, the roomettes. And again, the compartment is not a bad buy, considering that you get these, you know, free meals and all that with your compartment.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Phil on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, hi. I have taken the train a couple of times down to Austin, and no one seems to know about it, but it goes only one time a day, so it has to fit with your schedule. $15 is a reasonable price. I did rent a compartment, which is a little bit more. But it was, you know, it takes about 4 hours, between 4 and 4.5 hours, so it's a little longer than going by car. But to me, braving the highways with college students and Mexican truckers, I'll take train travel to any time. And Kevin, I don't know whether you used the word in your article, civilized, but to me that's a word that comes to mind with my train travel. There's no frisking. You're not sitting knee to knee with someone else, and you can spread out a little bit. They've got a bar. They've got, you know, the dining car you talked about. And in the case of Austin, it's a completely different look to the travel. You're traveling through country that you've never seen before because you're not going on the interstate or on the highway.
Thank you so much for your call, Phil.
Yeah, thanks. I would agree with that. I found it very civilized and eye-opening in many ways. You know, I mean, there are the compartments and there are the roomettes, but most people traveling, even on the long-distance trains, are traveling in the regular coach. They're traveling in the regular seats. And they're, you know, because they're not necessarily going the whole 48 hours or something like that. But and in that, you not only, it's not only very civilized and you meet some terrific people, but you meet all sorts of different people. I mean, I was, as I write in the article, at one point I went back to the cafe car in the evening to see if, you know, who was sitting around there and doing what. And what it was this whole extended Amish family who were on their way to some family wedding. And they were sitting up there in their, you know, kind of antiquated Amish clothing and not, you know, not using any social media, not drinking, not doing anything, simply sitting there and talking to each other in this kind of German dialect that they use and have used since they, you know, came to this country. And this just struck me as an amazing thing. It's like it's seeing another part of America that you wouldn't see on a plane and you certainly wouldn't see probably anywhere else unless you live in Amish country. You know, it's it was almost like time travel in a way, seeing how people would have been going across the country 150 years ago.
Is it possible using trains, Kevin, to get pretty much from any mid-sized U.S. city to any other?
Pretty much so, yeah. I would say Amtrak still has enough of a network for that. And it's constantly under threat because the really profitable part of Amtrak is that Northeast Corridor, which is where it makes 80% of its money. And it makes, it makes a profit, an operating profit of something like $200 million a year. No other part of the inner city Amtrak is profitable in that sense, but it's, you know, interestingly, it's been kept alive over these many years as much by Republicans in Congress as Democrats because it serves a lot of small towns as well in these sort of so-called red state areas that have no other real access to ready access to the outside world. So it was quite amazing for me to, you know, you go past these places like Shelby, Montana, this town of about 3,000 people, but it's, you know, served twice a day by the Amtrak going west and going east. And, you know, this is, it's a great connection to those places as well as to the cities.
Shelby has a fascinating history when it comes to the existence of the railroad through there.
Yes, Shelby believed a little too much in the power of the railroad, and they decided that in order to make themselves into a big resort destination back in the 1920s, they would have to hold the heavyweight championship fight, heavyweight championship of the world fight there between Jack Dempsey and Tom Kearns, and they set up this fight there, and they thought just, well, the railway will bring people in and bring them out, and it won't really matter where you have this fight. You know, it was a thought that maybe the rails could annihilate distance, as they often had around America, and annihilate time. And it didn't work out. The railroads didn't believe the fight was really going to come off. A lot of people didn't believe it was going to come off, and very few people showed up for the fight, and it practically bankrupted the state of Montana at the time. You know, bankrupted every bank in the region, and Dempsey and his manager ended up literally running for the train to get out of town. But, you know, today, to this day, Amtrak is still serving Shelby, and it's a bigger town than it was then. It is 3,000 people. Unfortunately, we've passed at night, so I couldn't really see much of it, but, you know, it's still out there on the prairie, and it's connected to the rest of America by rail.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Greg is on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Kevin. I've traveled on Amtrak here in the United States and also high-speed rail in Europe. And I was wondering, Kevin, you mentioned the California boondoggle. Here in Texas, we have two gubernatorial candidates that won't even mention high-speed rail, and we don't have either low-speed rail going from Dallas to Houston. Are you aware, Do you know about Tom Schieffer and the Japanese effort to build high-speed rail in Texas? And all?
Oh, I don't.
Well, it's supposed to be privatized, and I was just seeing what you thought about them getting eminent domain through Texas and that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I know the Japanese offered to build a length of rail between, like the Baltimore-Washington Railroad and airport and Washington. So certainly there have been a lot of abuses of eminent domain over the years. So I could see why people would be wary of it. But Texas, in some ways, would be a great place to have some of these rail corridors. You have a lot of cities now. You have fantastic old train stations, not necessarily used for trains anymore, but you still have those great stations in Fort Worth and San Antonio and El Paso. It would be, a terrific idea to pursue, but unfortunately people tend to think of it as a boondoggle, and, it doesn't have to be at all. It can be quite efficient and quite cheaply run, as Amtrak has shown. Unfortunately, the California thing has been a thing where the contractors kind of got into it, and so they're elevating much of it, and they're going to build 22,000 concrete pillars across the center of the state there and run this train through a lot of these towns it won't even stop in, and that's just going to antagonize people and really turn them off train travel, and it's going to make all train travel look bad. So, I mean, I guess kind of the lesson of that is you can do anything badly, but if trains can work very well in cutting down on the highway and airport congestion.
We're speaking this hour with Kevin Baker of Harper's Magazine. He read the cover story for the July issue. It's called 21st Century Limited, The Lost Glory of America's Railroads. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Kevin Baker. His article in Harper's Magazine is called 21st Century Limited, The Lost Glory of America's Railroads. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Kevin, you mentioned a few minutes ago that there are still just gorgeous Union stations in the downtown areas of a lot of American cities.
Right.
But a lot of them have been turned into shopping malls and plazas for other things.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a good thing in the sense that it saved these incredible structures, which were many of the most beautiful public buildings ever built. It's a real tribute to often to local government and state government that they were able to bring people together and kind of find a new purpose for these things. But it's sort of a shame that the Amtrak doesn't stop at them anymore. You know, it's these used to be really a way to kind of introduce people to your cities. They were a kind of focal point of life, and you would come in through this, and it was a testament to how great a city you had, you had built. You know, it's the thing about the late lamented Penn Station in New York, is that you used to once you entered the city, rode into the city like an emperor, and now you like a god, and now you scuttle in like a cockroach, to the horrible thing that's replaced it. This is, and that's sort of a shame. I mean, out in Cleveland, for instance, they still have gorgeous station downtown. It's part of a beautiful skyscraper and a whole beautiful downtown area. But it's, you know, the Amtrak no longer stops there, just a few commuter lines. Instead, you have to go out through what the foamers like to call Amshacks, which are these kind of terrible, jerry-rigged little, you know, stations that are just appalling, you know.
But the rent's cheaper.
Yeah, much cheaper. Well, you know, you stopped out in the middle of the night. I mean, it was like refugees escaping or something in Cleveland. You know, the train stopped in the middle of the night. It was 3 in the morning. I peered blurrily out the window of my compartment and saw these people kind of skulking across the tracks to this parking lot behind a wire fence where they could get in their cars. You know, this is not something that will encourage rail travel anywhere, knowing you have to kind of disembark this way. And that's a shame, you know, because for a fairly small amount of money, you could figure out ways to hook up a lot of these big old stations to Amtrak again. But unfortunately, the money's not there.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Tony on the line in Grand Prairie. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
My girlfriend and I are kind of semi-regular Amtrak riders.
Yeah.
We try to take one long distance trip a year. One thing I wanted to mention your guest said about the sleeping cars. East of the Mississippi is one kind of sleeping car, which is a single level, and west of the Mississippi is the dual level ones. They're a little bit different. A super liner on the west of the Mississippi and a view liner east of the Mississippi.
Huh. I was on the ones west of the Mississippi, but they seem the same. Are they? Do you mean to say that they have like a double bed that can, you know?
No. They're you have rooms. You have two levels of rooms: lower level and upper level.
Huh. Oh, okay. Yeah, but I mean, you can't. The single compartment doesn't go between the levels, right?
No. And east of Mississippi, they're single level because the taller superliners won't go under in through the tunnels. The tunnels are too short.
Yeah, and for the most part, you don't have double deckers. East of the Mississippi for that same reason, and you don't have the observation cars like you do west of the Mississippi. But you know, that's the scenery is so much kind of grander west of the Mississippi anyway. It's best to have them there, I think.
Do you think that is there a possibility that we will no longer have the option to travel on trains in the next few decades?
Oh, yeah, I think it's, I think certain commuter lines, will go on and on, but I think it's entirely possible that an all-Republican federal administration might finally pull the plug on Amtrak and try to privatize it, which I suspect would be the end of it. Perhaps it would survive in the Northeast Corridor, but even that would be a struggle. And I think people would really miss it if it went. I think it's that would be a terrible shame, and it would also just lead to that many more cars on the road, that many more sprawling airports. But I think it's entirely possible that we could do that.
It is strange that I know Americans who can't wait to get to Europe and travel on trains, who don't think about that. It just doesn't enter their thinking for planning trips within the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, supposedly only 2% of Americans say they've ever set foot on an Amtrak train, something I find hard to believe from seeing the variety of people, on the trains. Makes me wonder if they didn't quite realize what an Amtrak train was, when they were polled about this. But it's not terribly high, and it's something like only 3% commute by train. So, it's not something that, there's that big a constituency for. And it could well be the case that, people just feel like, oh, we don't want to spend our money on it. Of course, it's a phenomenally small amount of money. I mean, it's, the estimate is that that Americans pay $4.07 per year for the federal subsidy of Amtrak, and believe me, your government is wasting much more than that on many other much worse ideas. But that it may be something with the kind of obsession with budget cutting and all. It may be become a victim of that in the years ahead.
Let's go back to the phones now. Dan is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Well, I just have two quick comments. The first, I just called to sing the praises of Amtrak
in the Northeast. I used to live in Washington and did not own a car. And we used to get up, take the Metro to Union Station, which, by the way, is a very nice train station.
Oh, yeah.
And then hop on the train to New York City and spend the day in New York and come back late at night. And it was cheap. It was quick. And it's probably a lot quicker to take the train to New York from Washington than to attempt to fly, when you figure in traffic and what have you. But sadly, I would like to take a trip from Dallas to see my family in Washington by train, which would mean going through Chicago. When I priced out the rooms, the sleeper cars, it was cost prohibitive. It was almost $1,000 round trip. And, how do you justify that when you can fly Southwest for $150 round trip?
There is that problem with it. It's because the subsidies are pretty limited, and the subsidies are, it depends. There's constant fights over how you define this, but the subsidies are much more limited than what we provide for highways or for airlines. But because the subways are pretty limited, the subsidies are pretty limited, the price is still fairly high on a lot of intercity, trips like that. And that's a shame. That'd be something really worth looking into as a way to try to make it. I think the whole real concentration of the Obama administration should have been on making that sort of travel faster and cheaper, and then then kind of moving on to more high tech stuff. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case.
So, did we waste the $8 billion he did pledge?
Oh no, I don't think it was. Well, it depends what part of it will be spent on California, which is yet to be fully determined. But a lot of it was put into, various other necessary updates of maintenance of the tracks and buying of engines, which are, will all be very worthwhile. But $8 billion is such a drop in the bucket compared to what we spent in the stimulus program in general, compared to what we spend all the time on other things. Federal highway subsidies were $41.5 billion in 2013. Federal aviation subsidies were $16 billion. Amtrak received $1.6 billion. We're not funding this at anywhere near what we fund airlines and highways at. Again, there are all sorts of fights about that. You can say that, highways fund themselves through tolls more than trains do. But it would really, I think, benefit us all to put some more money into trains and to try to cut these costs down.
Let's talk on the phone now to Robert in Fort Worth. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Hey.
This is a great subject, and I'm enjoying your show. I would like to say that I traveled on Amtrak from Fort Worth to Chicago about a year ago, and I found it great. It was a great experience. Talk to people I would never have met, enjoyed it completely. One problem, though, I am a vegan, and there was this food selection was very limited, but I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're allowed to bring on your own stuff, so that was a wonderful plus. But I think one place where Amtrak is really missing it is to deal with other environmental-minded people and opening up to bicycle travel, because there are a lot of bicycle tourists, I think, that would take the train if they didn't have to partially disassemble their bicycles and box them to move them about. I know there's some of that done on the West Coast, but I think if we make it, I would love to go to Austin, be downtown, jump on my bike, and go wherever I wanted to go.
It's an interesting idea. I wasn't aware that you had to box up your bike.
Yeah, you should probably write and suggest that to them. I mean, they're fairly open to ideas. Also one way to reduce costs, I should have mentioned before, they have, you can get Amtrak miles through certain credit cards. I know I do that. And a lot of the people I was traveling with were doing that. Whenever you make a purchase, you get it's like air miles. You get a certain number of Amtrak miles, and you can, you can travel for free at times, when you run up enough points. You might want to look into that if you were interested in traveling long distance.
I think
some of the people I was traveling with were just—they run up hundreds of thousands of points just making everything on every purchase on their Amtrak card.
Those must have been foamers.
Yes, they were definitely foamers.
We have time, I think, for one more call. Pete is on the line in Dallas. Hey, Pete.
Hi there. I had a question. I've got three small children and wondered the practicality of taking them on a long train trip and whether that is possible. And I also had a question if anybody had ever looked at the high-speed freight and if that could relieve congestion and if that's ever been looked at.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. Yeah, I don't know how fast freight runs, but I mean, American, you know, it's the oddity that American passenger trains are considered a laughingstock in the rest of the world, according to Time magazine, but American freight trains are considered far and away the industry standard. And we ship much more by freight than, we ship something like 10 times what all of the European Union does by freight rail. They're really, you know, I mean, of course, now they're suffering from all these, you know, all this neglected infrastructure and crashing, but I don't know if you want them going too much faster on the current rail beds we have, but certainly they're really state of the art. I think for traveling with small children, I think if you're traveling on some of those Western cars, you know, there were kids in the observation cars, and they seem to be having a good time. They can stare out the window. They're kind of spacious enough to walk back and forth on the car and everything. I think if you're traveling long distance, but, you know, east of the Mississippi with small kids, they might get a little restless at the space restrictions if you're going for a very long time. But, you know, there's certainly windows you can look out there, too, and, you know, you can, there's room to play games and look at your, look at the Internet and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, bring a bunch of videos for the computer, and you'll probably be all right.
Do you think it's possible that the passenger rail industry simply needs to up its marketing game?
Oh, I think that would be that would really help. I think, you know, but again, it's like, as with all these kind of, you know, there are plenty of problems Amtrak has that you just think, boy, if they could just do this, and they, you know, it would improve it. But it's the trouble is just they don't have the funding for it. You know, they have so much money that must go into simply maintaining stock and maintaining rails, just trying to kind of, keep the whole thing running, that they don't have a lot of money for an advertising budget, and they don't have a lot of money for, you know, saying how good they are. And I think that's, that's something else they could benefit from.
Have you got your next itinerary planned?
Only on free rail miles, only up to Hartford, Connecticut from New York for a friend's daughter's wedding. But my wife and I are able to do that free thanks to all our Amtrak points. We're looking forward to that.
Kevin Baker is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He wrote the cover story this July. It's called 21st Century Limited, The Lost Glory of America's Railroads. Kevin, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
No, thanks so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canaby. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.